Good evening. Welcome to the New York 21st Congressional Candidates Forum. Is the mic okay? My name is Lisa Basoy Pedersen, and I'm a proud member of North Country Respect. Respect is an acronym for Ready to Educate, Support, and Protect Equality and Civility Together. We are a social justice group that formed last year as we began to be concerned with issues surrounding us. We meet every month or two as a whole and have several subgroups, each with their own focus and agenda. And these include education, the environment, immigration and refugees, equality and LGBTQ concerns, Social Security and Medicare, healthcare, and midterm elections, which I chair. We are pleased that everyone is here tonight to learn about the candidates for the 2018 election. One thing I want to add is make sure you fill out your audience participation response sheet. And if you don't have one, there's plenty in front. And if you would select a number from between 1 and 5 for each candidate for each question, that would be great. And then also you can vote in this straw poll. Who do you think will be the most effective representative for New York 21? And then you can drop them off in the front tables as you leave. Thanks so much and enjoy the forum. Our moderator, Pat Bradley.
Good evening. I'm Pat Bradley. I'm with WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, and I will be moderating this evening. Thank you for joining us for this 21st District North Country Respect Congressional Candidate Forum. I will very quickly review the rules and expectations, and then we'll move directly into the candidates' opening statements. Because of the large number of candidates, I would ask that everybody hold their applause when they are giving their answers, except following the initial introductions and again at the end of the evening. I would also ask that the candidates, particularly since we have to share the microphones tonight, remain seated when you're answering questions and throughout the evening so that we can quickly and efficiently move to the next speaker. Thank you. The rules for this evening. There will be a series of long-form questions that each candidate will have 90 seconds, that's a minute and a half, to answer. There will be no rebuttals or second responses. The timekeeper, Kimberly, will wave a yellow flag at 30 seconds and a red flag when you have 5 seconds remaining. I will cut you off at the 90-second mark. I'll let you finish the sentence, but we've got a lot of candidates here. You will need to be cut off. A number of topics have been submitted by North Country Respect, but I have made the final selection and have not told anyone the potential or the final questions. We will also do quick bullet rounds or speed rounds, however you'd like to call them, with very short answers, preferably about a 5-second response. Yes, no, very short phrase answers. The order of seating and the opening statements was determined by a random drawing earlier. From left to right, our participants are Tedra Cobb, Ronald Kim, Katie Wilson, Russ Finley, Tanya Boone, Don Boyajian, Steve Craig, Patrick Nelson, and Emily Martz. Steve Craig is a Republican. He will be a Democrat after January. And Russ Finley is also a Republican. The remaining participants are all Democrats. Incumbent second-term Republican Elise Stefanik declined several invitations to participate. Ms. Cobb?
Yes.
You have 90 seconds for your opening statement.
Thank you for being here. Winter has arrived, and so it is really lovely to be here tonight, and I want to say thank you for everyone to come out on this chilly night. My name is Tedra Cobb, and I'm running for Congress to bring compassionate and competent government back to Northern New York. If I am fortunate enough to be elected, I will represent you really with my guiding principles of problem solving and with constituent services always at my forefront. Northern New York has been my home for about 30 years. I went to SUNY Potsdam. I don't think it's a rival of Plattsburgh, but SUNY Potsdam, and I stayed. I raised my children here, started a healthcare organization, and also my own business, and I also ran for county legislature. And I won, and I represented my district for 8 years. It's important for me to remember why I got into politics. And so tonight, I hope that I get to communicate that with you fully. I want you to know that being a public servant is important to me, and that will drive me as I make decisions, as I think about the questions that you ask tonight. And I hope that I will be able to give you an understanding of who I am and how I would serve should you choose to elect me.
Ronald Kim.
Thank you for having me. My name is Ronald Kim. I'm running for Congress because I have a plan to defeat Elise Stefanik. Three reasons I think I can do that. First, I have actually defeated an incumbent in a race. I ran for, in 2005, Saratoga Springs Commissioner of Public Safety. These are citywide races in a city of about 20,000. This is not just a district. This is citywide. He's a 10-year incumbent. I beat him. Nobody believed it. I wasn't sure myself. I did that. The second reason I believe that I can beat Elise Stefanik is I have extensive experience outside of Washington. That's what you need. I've maintained a private law practice. I've worked with Legal Aid as their volunteer president for 10 years. I've done a variety of things. I hope you pick up my sheet to show you to learn more about my background. It's too difficult in 90 seconds. The final reason that I believe that I can beat Elise Stefanik is we need to get some of the Trump voters back. We need to be true to our progressive values, but we need to get some of those people back, or we're not going to win, folks. And those people have come to me over the years in my private practice because they've lost their houses, because they've lost their jobs. That's the kind of work I do in my private practice. And I know the kind of people and their needs and how we can address those through our progressive values. Thank you.
Katie Wilson.
It's a pleasure to be here tonight. But the average income in the North Country is only $27,000 a year. And almost 20% of our children are still living in poverty. That's why I'm running for Congress. I'm running for Congress because a hard-working district like ours, full of working-class citizens, deserves a representative and a voice in D.C. who understands what it's like to make ends meet here in the North Country. Now, I'm a single mother, and my beautiful children are actually here in the audience tonight. And I'm not sure how many single parents there are out here in the audience, but there is one single mother in all of Congress, one woman representing 25% of households across America. Now, I'm here to give all children and all families a voice. We need equal representation more than ever right now. We are experiencing an economy of hopelessness here in the North Country. The wealth inequality, the wealth gap has never been so wide. And right now, the country is more divided than it's been in decades. We must come together. Now is the time. There's an opportunity for unity. And it can start right here in New York 21. I'm Katie Wilson, and I'm here to fight for the hardworking people of New York 21.
Russ Finley.
Good evening. I'm Russ Finley. Thank you all for being here. As I look out, I see so many people. I've been around politics quite a while. And these events drawing so many people tells me that we have a district where people, they want to be informed, they want to listen. And this is what is so important, is the people of this district We live together. We work together. We don't identify as Republicans, Democrats. We'll pick on each other. We'll do this. We'll do that. But we never – we're a community, and that's one of the things that I love about North Country Values. Now, the reason I'm running is because, frankly, I'm offended. I'm offended that our representative is not here, has not been here, and will not be at any of the upcoming events. The fact that I sit here as the lone Republican, that doesn't bother me. Now, what I am is a conservative. I believe in conservative values, people putting money, keeping their own money in their pocket, lower taxes, and freedom and free market enterprise. But the fact is, we're all here. We're all sitting together. There's been no disrespect. Where the disrespect has been in Washington, D.C., is by both parties letting us down, just doing this kabuki theater of running back and forth and accomplishing nothing and holding us hostage while they do it. Thank you.
Tanya Boone.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. My name is Tanya Boone, and I'm from Granville, New York. It's a small town in Washington County of about 6,000 people. And I was motivated to run for Congress because my grandparents were able to live a different life than folks are today. They worked blue-collar jobs, and they were able to live a middle-class life. And I don't see that with this generation. It's more of a struggle. My brother works two full-time jobs and actually works odd jobs on the weekend just to get by, just barely get by. And this isn't because he works less hard than my grandparents. It's because the rules of the economy have fundamentally changed to favor the very wealthy over working families. A perfect example of this is the tax bill that is being considered right now. It's going to cost us $1.5 trillion in tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans and big corporations. And if we were serious about creating good jobs in this country, what we need here in this district is an infrastructure bill that can really change things. So I think the primary challenge in our country right now is how do we rebuild the middle class? And I think I'm uniquely qualified to fight on that because I've been a union organizer for 12 years. I've been a small business owner of a struggling small business. And I went and got an MBA, and I've worked for GE Healthcare for the last 6 years. So thank you.
Don Boyajian.
Thank you. You know, we deserve better. You know, upstate New York has been getting a raw deal ever since I was a little kid. I've had dozens of my childhood friends that I grew up playing outside and fishing with. As they got older, they had to get up and leave. And it was just because they couldn't find a job here. That's not a good path to be going down. And we can't afford to go down that path any longer. But I'm so confident that we can change that path. We can correct it and get on the right trajectory. And the time to do that is now. But we need a champion and a fighter that's going to make that happen, especially at the federal level. And I know what it means to be a champion and to fight. I've been a champion of environmental issues ever since I was younger. I went to school in upstate New York, Colgate, then Cornell Law, solely to work on environmental issues. I have represented communities in upstate New York fighting against corporate polluters. And you know, I have worked in Congress at a time when Congress was a champion for the American people. In 2009, day one, we passed Lilly Ledbetter. 2 weeks in, the stimulus package. That's being a champion for America, investing in America. But Congress, they're not fighting for us anymore, and they're certainly not fighting for upstate New York. And that's why I'm running for Congress, because we deserve better.
Steve Craig.
Hi, I'm Steve Krieg. I came here 40 years ago as an airman in the Air Force. I graduated from Clinton Community College while I was on active duty, and I stayed and graduated from Plattsburgh State afterward. Except for 5 years I was away at college, I've lived in the district ever since. I'm an optometrist in Plattsburgh, and I've been on the Plattsburgh City School Board since 2010. Up until a year ago, I wasn't considering running for anything other than school board again. Then racism and religious bigotry reared its ugly head. A proud, ignorant man was elected president. When I saw the Republicans trying to sell the bogus American Health Care Act, I was so disgusted I changed from Republican to Democrat. Even though I consider myself pro-life and pro-Second Amendment, before the vote, I called Elise Stefanik's office expressing concern about the effects the act would have on school children who needed speech therapy and occupational therapy. I was speaking as a school board member on behalf of school children. I got no response from Elise. I began to think about how I could get Elise out of Congress. When Donald Trump issued a thinly veiled threat to use nuclear weapons against North Korea, I made up my mind to run. When I was announced, I was attacked by people in Elise's camp, Fox News, and a few other news organizations, as well as a few people on this stage. I hold no
time,
grudges.
Time, Mr. Craig. Patrick Nelson.
So I want to thank North Country Respect for putting together this great forum, WAMC for putting it out, Pat Bradley for moderating. This is a really important discussion about the issues affecting people in the North Country. And thank you for being here. I've been organizing in this district for more than a few years now, and I can say I've never seen citizens so engaged with the political process. This here tonight, almost a year out from Election Day, is a great cause for hope, and this is what the political revolution looks like. So I know they said no rounds of applause, but really quietly to yourself, maybe give yourself a round of applause for being involved in the process. My name is Patrick Nelson, and I am running for the U.S. House of Representatives because the decisions we make as Americans and as human beings over the next two decades will determine the legacy of our country and the legacy of our species. We need to end the criminal level of negligence coming from our federal government surrounding climate change that threatens our economy and our national security. As Americans, we must come to our collective common sense and join the rest of the industrialized world in guaranteeing health care to all of our citizens as a right and reducing the obscene level of health care spending in this country by moving to a Medicare for all system. And at a time when the top 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90% of us, we must recognize that supply-side trickle-down economics is a scam. Giving more wealth and power to those who already have it through handouts from Washington, D.C. will not help working families in this district. Thank you.
Emily Martz.
My name is Emily Martz. I want to represent us in Congress because while the incumbent has been supporting major corporations and millionaires, I've been doing the job that she should have been doing. The next time you're in Messina, go into the boutique Two Mama Birds. In part because of a small business development program that I helped administer, there is now one more thriving storefront and one more thriving business and one less empty storefront. I grew up in a poor rural family. As many of us were, I was taught to earn what I need, help others along the way. And the biggest problem I see facing us now is that because of politicians in Washington, unless you have money to begin with, hard work isn't enough, particularly in rural America. But I have a vision. It involves the arts, infrastructure, healthcare, natural resources. I know from my work throughout this district that our rural economies, we have the power to create family-sustaining jobs that can put food on the table, money in the bank, if we invest in our biggest resources, our people and our landscape. Polling is telling us that 76% of swing voters want their leader to focus on growing the economy. That is my message. That has been my experience, the only candidate among us. So I ask for your vote. If we put Martz on the ballot in November, we can win this district.
And these are your nine candidates currently running in the 21st District Congressional race. This is your first opportunity to applaud if you'd like. So now we are going to move to our first 90-second question round. Each, obviously, will have 90 seconds to respond to the question. We'll start this round with the first answer from Mr. Kim. What cradle-to-career programs and funding should Congress promote, or what current federal programs could more successfully be utilized to enhance the transportation manufacturing sector and the supportive education programs in this region?
Well, I think the public-private public-private partnerships between schools like this, the community colleges, is a critical part of us developing those capacities within each of the in each community. And you know, in the district, we have five or six really good community colleges: ACC, Clinton County, Saranac Lake. That really can come. That have the synergy to sort of create the capacity to develop infrastructure. I have some particular proposals in that regard. That basically, the first one would be that we do a survey of our deteriorating roads, bridges, and water and sewer system, so that we can sort of understand, put our arms around the problem. As Commissioner of Public Safety, I was well aware of the problems that we had in this regard, and how critical it was to address these issues. And then once we got an arm around the problem, then we really have to sort of prioritize and then seek funding from funding sources in Congress, et cetera. So those would be the kinds of ways I would address this issue. Thank you.
Ms. Wilson?
That was a very long question, but I'll do my best to to recall. Let me just say that if we had taken, if we still take, because we could, there's an opportunity here, the kind of money that was just about to be transferred to some of the wealthiest Americans and put that into infrastructure, think of how many people across the North Country would benefit. We have some of the oldest pipes in the state, clay pipes, that need replacement. We have roads and bridges that need to be replaced. We need more access through airports. We still have almost 30% of the area lacking broadband. These are jobs. These are opportunities for people to find good-paying work. And right now, we're not actually, there isn't just a shortage of jobs. There's actually a shortage of skilled people to fill those jobs. I don't know if you all saw that article in the Watertown Daily Times, I'd say a week or two ago, but we're lacking nurses. We're lacking people to fill even jobs in the hospitality industry. There's an opportunity here through our BOCES and CV Tech programs and public-private partnerships like Ron was talking about through places like Clinton Community to train skilled individuals on even two-year direct entry career paths and put them to work right here in our communities and build our communities from within.
Mr. Finley.
Frankly, I believe we got to back up. Everybody keeps talking about these college public-private partnerships and everything like this. We need to look at our schools. Let's take a good hard look. Most of us in here, when we went to school, there was metal shop, there was wood shop, there was small engine shop, there was small home ec. Now, of course, usually the girls went to home ec, the guys like me went and nailed ourselves to something in the shop class. But the fact is, this is what we need to bring back. We need to bring back teaching kids skilled trades, getting their hands dirty, and the ability to work and the understanding that if you want something, you got to work for it. Honestly, frankly, right now, we've got a generation of people walking around with hands like this. We need to put more people out there. I'm a farmer. We need more people with hands like this. And that is why we have to take a good hard look at our education system, and we need to revamp the BOCES programs. We need to teach welders, skilled trade, electrical. No kid should come out of school not knowing how to do a little bit of electrical, change their own oil, change a tire. And also, yes, takeout isn't for everybody. Everybody should be taking a home ec class and knowing how to cook themselves decent meals.
Ms. Boone?
So as I said in the intro, I think it is critical, especially in this area, that we invest in infrastructure. And part of that is broadband and cell phone service. There's a whole area of the economy that where folks can't work in areas that there isn't broadband or cell phone service. I actually worked for GE Healthcare as a remote employee, so all I needed was a laptop and internet and cell phone. And it's difficult to work here. So we've got to change that so that we can grow businesses from infrastructure spending here. So what I mean by that is we've got to invest in roads and bridges, and we've got to invest in rural broadband so that we can lay the foundations so that businesses can grow and also be attracted to the area. And in terms of education, I do think it's important that we have more skill-based training, but earlier in an education in a student's life, we need to provide them with internship opportunities, even at the high school level, so that they know what jobs are possible, so they can start to think about how to use their education to get good jobs.
Mr. Boyajian.
Thank you. And I really like that question. I saw you see two components to it, the education side that you're talking about and the infrastructure side. And I really like that phrase, cradle to career. And I really believe firmly that infrastructure and education are two of the most important catalysts for job growth in upstate New York. I really do believe that, especially at the federal level. And that's where we're seeing big shortcomings. I like the points that people bring up about vocational training. But let me tell you about infrastructure, because I worked as a legislative aide for a member of Congress that sat on transportation and infrastructure, and he brought a lot of good back to the district, right back to the district. And that's something that would be job creating in our region. And I think there's two specific areas that we could really, we've seen cuts, community development block grants and Tiger grants. Those are job creating projects that go to rural America, and they've cut those programs. And when they cut those programs, you know where the burden falls? It falls on the local taxpayer, because the county and the local municipalities, they're picking up the scraps, trying to find the funding elsewhere, and it ultimately affects our local tax base. So federal government is not doing its job on infrastructure spending, and if we boosted programs like that, it would really be a boon for a boost to our region. Thank you.
Mr. Krieg.
So I was a Republican for a long time, and I'm not real big on government grants and tax breaks. I think that those are given out by politicians to buy votes most of the time and not so much based on need. I am a big proponent of education. I've been on the school board for quite a while, and I think that that's where we need to put most of our emphasis if we want to have people prepared and get good employers up here to give them good jobs. And Russ, I don't know if you know, but I mean the BOCES do teach all that stuff that you were talking about. I mean we do teach it. I know because I'm involved in it. And also I'm a big proponent of community college. I did go to Clinton Community College, and I think it's a wonderful place for kids to start. It's also a wonderful place with a new advanced manufacturing institute for people to get experience at jobs that they can do right now, right here. Without going on to school somewhere else. Of course, we need to improve infrastructure. That's what employers look at when they want to come to an area. They don't want to come to an area that doesn't have good infrastructure, so that's something where government should be doing some work. Also, I came back to this area because I loved it here. I love the recreational opportunities here, and I think New York offers that, and we need to promote that. Thank you.
Mr. Nelson.
I also find it interesting that we're putting infrastructure and education in the same question, and I agree that we should approach these with the same idea as investments in the long-term future of our country. How are we going to compete in a global economy when we have countries like Germany out there that have tuition-free higher education, and when you have countries like Denmark that offer their students a stipend to go to school? So they're providing an incentive for people to become educated. Here in the United States, what do we have? Student debt, $1.3 trillion of it, functioning as a disincentive for people to get educated. This is a global economy. The better educated our workforce is, the more we're going to be able to compete. So in the history of education, primary school used to be the cutoff for public funding. Then it was 8th grade. Then it was moved to 12th grade. And in 2017, it's time for a higher education to be publicly financed. It's time for tuition-free public universities and trade schools and community colleges. In terms of infrastructure in this district and transportation, with climate change, we are going to lose farmable land throughout the country. But Here in the North Country, it's very likely that we're going to experience a longer growing season. That means more people will be depending upon the products that we produce here, and that's why we need to invest in things like the rooftop highway to make it easier for our farmers to get their goods to market, because there's going to be greater demand on the food we produce here, not just for the benefit of our district, but for the benefit of the broader Northeast. We need to invest in North Country infrastructure.
Ms. Martz.
How do I see us investing in our region's future? And I heard the question begin with cradle to grave. And I do believe that it begins there in our region, in that we need to make sure that as we're talking about education, we're also starting with affordable and accessible childcare. We talk a lot about empowering women in our region, and I know from talking with women around the district that indeed for their families and for themselves, childcare is something. And there are efforts throughout the district that could certainly use a supporter at the federal level. The second is the infrastructure. Indeed, I was on the Downtown Advisory Board and in Saranac Lake, and we had several businesses contact us to find out more, to see if they wanted to relocate. And as soon as we said that we did not have high-speed broadband, they said they had to look elsewhere. It's also important for education. Those of you who have children know how much online work there is. And in terms of education, indeed, the vocational education, access to higher education of whatever sort is best for students. And since that's been covered, I will mention one more piece that needs to be considered when it comes to investing in this region's future, and that is transportation, actual transportation in rural America. There are indeed, as people have pointed out, jobs available, particularly in Plattsburgh with the U.S.-Canadian integration. It's difficult for a lot of people to access that, so we need someone at the federal level thinking about rural transportation differently.
Ms. Cobb.
May I ask if you repeat it? I'd like to
it's
just
been
do
a
one
while.
More time. Thanks, sorry.
What cradle-to-career programs and funding should Congress promote, or what current federal programs could more successfully be utilized to enhance the transportation manufacturing sector and supportive education programs in this region?
Thank you. Thanks. I think the first thing, I'm taking this question, when we talk about cradle and federal programs, we need to start with Head Start. We need full-time pre-K. We need an integration of understanding computers at those early ages. When my children were in school, my daughter had a friend who didn't own a computer. We still have those kinds of hurdles. So I'm thinking about the federal programs that you've talked about, Head Start. Also, we need Title I, which provides school districts for additional remedial services. Many North Country schools receive Title I funding. So for me, I'm taking the question, thinking about specifically, what does the federal government provide now, and also what are we at risk of losing? So I agree with everyone on the stage in terms of infrastructure. I was just at a summit in Saratoga, and they were talking about 5G. 5G. I cannot get AT&T at my home, but I can get Verizon, and I own my own business.
Thank you. That's the first question. Our second question, the answer will start with Katie Wilson. And the question is, last month, President Trump declared the addiction and opioid crisis a public health emergency, short of a national emergency, and he also did not request additional funding to address the issue. As a House member, how will you help local and regional services that are struggling to provide treatment and recovery options?
Well, this is, of course, about funding. And the fact that no additional funds were appropriated is incredibly disturbing, especially for someone who appears to be taking this seriously. What I would do first and foremost is add more beds. In a 12-county district, we have 7 detox beds in the entire district, and they are all in St. Lawrence County. There are a couple other programs looking for funding right now. They look good. It looks like they're going to go through, but this is about funds. It's also about peer-to-peer services, and it's about stigma. We need to continue bringing people together and sharing stories. We need to be careful about how we treat children coming up. You know, this is an opportunity, you know, as we were talking about an opportunity for internships and mentorships, you know, here's an opportunity for our youth to learn from our aging seniors and have a discussion about how this affects a life. Let's bring more people into the schools. You know, we have a great program that I remember in the public schools around here, and there's a new man, I forget what the program's called, but they come in and it's like a drug education. And I caught him on the way out of school the other day, and he said, you know, this program really needs some updating. I was in the fourth grade class the other day, and one of the kids came up to me and asked me what a vape pen was. So it's a whole new world. You know, we need to approach this with creativity.
Russ Finley?
First of all, you can take many, many social issues and take it back to the economy. I mean, you look back through history. When the factory closes, what's the business that takes off? The liquor store. As the economy goes down, more and more people turn to drugs and self-medicate and whatever. So to me, fixing the economy, giving people something to live for, giving something people a reason to get up every day, and so when they have a job, they actually look at that and they say, I really have something to lose now. So economics is a very, very strong part of it. Another thing is border security. A report came out the other day, 70% of the Oxycontin and fentanyl that's coming in is coming in through our southern border and through our borders from China. So we need strong border security to stop that stuff coming in. If you start working on those things, and then also legislation like, I understand that when people need a prescription, like after something as routine as a colonoscopy or something, instead of getting like three Oxycontin pills or Percocet or something, they have to take a whole prescription of 30. So we have to start looking at legislation like that and start doing it. And then, yes, obviously, there is going to have to be funding involved in this and increasing the number of beds. But I want to try and fix the economy so that people have a reason to not do drugs.
Tanya Boone.
So I think we have to look at this as a crisis and treat it that way. I don't think there's probably anyone in the room that hasn't been impacted by a family member or a friend or someone that's had a problem with opioid use. And I think we've got to treat the symptoms and figure out how there's funding for rehab for folks that are struggling. And then beyond that, we've got to make sure to hold those accountable that really helped create this crisis. And that's in the distributors of, you know, over-prescribing. It's, you know, if we look at how the distributors were allowing so many prescriptions to go through, I mean, they're the ones that really need to be held accountable, kind of similar to how we did with the tobacco industry.
Don Voyagin.
You know, a little over a month ago, I was at a funeral. A good friend of mine, professional colleague, but a good friend, too, and His son had just died from an overdose, and you look around in that room, and you're like, this was a good family. This kid grew up spending time with his family. He was raised well. What the heck happened? But the truth is, you see that happening all over the place, and it's particularly bad where we live in upstate New York. And you know, it's, you may not know this, but Clinton County, the rate is 25% above the rest of upstate New York. I actually just read that a couple days ago. So it's particularly bad in Clinton County. And there's two sides to the issue. What are we going to do with the people suffering from this affliction? You know, this problem. Putting them in prison isn't gonna do it. They have an illness. I think we need to be looking at alternative ways to deal with when they have this problem, whether it's deferred prosecutions or drug court type programs that gives them incentive to get the help that they need. I also think the funding is everybody hit that point. It's very key. But the last point is also it goes to what was the source of this? And you got to look at the pharmaceutical companies. They were pushing this stuff on us, and we need to get them under control and hold them accountable. And Congress could do that if they wanted to, and that's what I would do.
Steve Krieg?
Yeah, I think this is really a question of health care, and we need a an integrated healthcare system in this country that includes mental health care and substance abuse care, which is really, the two are very related. I think all of us have had some experience with this, I know my family has, with friends that have been involved with heroin and with ourselves, starting with my father's generation that I know about, with mental health problems that are treated, and we do well with the treatment that we have. And that's key to getting this problem solved. And we need to have a system in this country. What we have now is, I call it a healthcare industry. We do not have a healthcare system. We have a healthcare industry. We need a system, and we need to work toward that. And I have some ways that I think we can work toward that. I don't think we can step right into Medicare for all, but I think we can work toward it in a logical way and get to it fairly quickly if we do it that way. And that's what I would work toward in Congress, is working in that direction. Thank you.
Patrick Nelson.
First and foremost, President Trump cannot be taken seriously on the opioid epidemic when he's pushing a health care bill that slashes funding for Medicaid. And Medicaid is one of the principal providers of treatment for opioid addiction. I had a friend who struggled with this addiction. He was on Medicaid, and he was eligible for 4 days of outpatient treatment. That's not nearly enough. Thankfully, he was able to pull through and kick the habit, but that is a testament to his own self-interest and discipline in going through that process. We did not give him the help that he needed. So let's start with what's not working. If the war on drugs was effective drug policy, we would not have an opioid epidemic, now would we? So that's where we're getting the funding from. Let's take it out of enforcement and let's put it into treatment. Enforcement has failed. Regardless of the trillions of dollars that we have spent trying to deal with this on the supply side, addiction rates are higher, overdose rates are higher. It's time to end the war on drugs. Legalizing cannabis is part of this solution. States with legal cannabis have a 30% lower incidence of opioid-related hospitalizations and overdoses. I met a woman a few days ago who was a chronic pain patient who moved from opioids to medical cannabis, and she told me, and these are her words, it gave her life back because it's much less addictive and it's much less debilitating in terms of your ability to experience your life. We need to end the war on drugs and move forward with a universal healthcare system that includes drug treatment.
Emily Martz.
The first thing we need to remember is how we got into this. And this was a failure on the part of our federal government for holding the pharmaceuticals responsible for profiteering off of our health. Secondly, the question is, yes, of course we need more funding. And how? What do we do with that? And my focus would be on working with the local efforts. I know that here in Clinton County, there is the SPARC organization, and I've been learning about that, and I've been learning that the elements of a successful program is to be focusing on prevention, treatment, working with employers, working on recovery, and then redirecting addicts to the appropriate place, away from criminal justice, for example, and towards treatment or mental health services. And finally, It is very important to me that we are seeing this crisis for what it is, which is a social and community health crisis. It's also important to me that we remember that drugs were not considered a community or a mental health crisis until it hit the middle class white population. And so as we create programs and as we move forward, I would ask that we do everything we can to prevent this mistake from happening again, and we keep that front and center in our minds.
Tedra Cobb.
I think the first thing that we need to guide us is compassion in this instance. I think probably none of us have gone through life without addiction, and I'm not just talking about opioid addiction, but alcoholism or another drug or in our families. And so I think compassion and also treating the whole family unit, providing services to the whole family unit. We need community services that are embedded into the community. We also need beds for people to live in homes that support each other so that peers can support each other as they recover from addiction and they transition back into their lives. We need support for veterans and peers of veterans. There are many programs that are peer-to-peer programs for veterans. We also need education for police officers and nursing and emergency services. We need to treat addiction as an addiction and that it's not a criminal offense. And finally, we need to hold the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies accountable. Insurance companies could provide medical marijuana in New York State, but they are not. And I think that the person that Patrick met is a woman that I met several months ago. And I said to her the other day, "You look marvelous. You look amazing." And she said, "I'm taking medical marijuana." But you can't get that in the North Country. We need support and help. So people can live their lives.
Ronald Kim.
Everyone has suggested that the things that we need to do, I agree with those things. How do we pay for it? I think we have to focus on big pharma. And essentially what we need to do is Congress needs to go to them and say, look, you're paying for this. You created the problem. You're paying for it. It's not going to be something that we're going to be able to do cheaply. It's going to be expensive, but we have to do this. So, yes, we have to add beds. We have to add people who will treat these problems. We have to, from top to bottom, add resources. But who's going to pay for it? Big Pharma is going to pay for this. But here's the thing, and this is the part of where even Democrats have failed us in the past. We've been it's been too easy to align ourselves with big corporations like Big Pharma, and we've not held them accountable. This is one where we have to hold them accountable and say, look, you created this problem, you're going to pay for it. And we start from that conversation, you're going to do this, because ultimately that's how we're going to get this problem solved. I agree the war on drugs failed a long time ago. As Commissioner of Public Safety, I saw that we could pour resources in interdiction. It wasn't stopping it. We now have to treat it. Thank you.
And that is the second of the longer form questions on the first part of this agenda. We now move to our speed round. These are where we expect very short answers from the candidates, ranging from local to national to quirky subjects. Maybe not so much quirky, but kind of different sort of questions, where hopefully they can give us some very, very short questions within maybe 5 seconds or so. And the first speed round question, Russ Finley, you get to answer. Should the Lake Placid North Country and general New York region host another Winter Olympics?
Well, 30 years, 30 pounds, and a full head of hair ago. I was on the U.S. bobsled team, so you betcha. Bring it back.
Tanya Boone.
Yes, I think it would be a huge boon for the community and would bring a lot of energy here.
Don Boyajian.
Absolutely, yes.
Steve Krieg.
These things tend to become boondoggles. I would say I would be in favor of partnering with Montreal, Canada, and doing it that way. Otherwise, I think it'd be ridiculously expensive and not doable.
Patrick Nelson.
I love the idea. I'd want to talk with the people in Lake Placid first to make sure it's something they want to do. But if they're for it, then I'm for it.
Emily Martz.
I would support it if we worked with Canada to do it. And if we made sure that we controlled this and not the International Olympic Organization.
Tedra Cobb.
Yes.
Ronald Kim.
I was there when we won the gold medal for hockey. So, yes. But we used it as an opportunity to put high-speed rail from New York City up to the Adirondacks.
Katie Wilson.
You know, I hadn't thought of the high-speed rail component, but otherwise I'd say absolutely not. We cannot we don't have the infrastructure. The only reason we pulled it off in 1980 is because we were building all those prisons. So unless y'all want a bunch more prisons in the area, it's not going to happen. We can't. We just can't sustain what it would take to bring those games back.
Tanya Boone, you get the next speed round question. Who do you consider to be the current leader of your national party?
This is, so.
I didn't say they'd be easy, just quit.
Thank you. Up until 3 days ago, I would have said Kirsten Gillibrand, and I know there's a big controversy right now, so she's taking a lot of heat, but I would still say Kirsten Gillibrand.
Don Bayajian.
I don't think we have one right now. We've lost our message. We lost the support of working Americans, and we need to fight and earn that back, and the Democratic Party needs to get back to what it used to be about standing up for the middle class.
Steve Krieg.
Angela Merkel. I had to go with somebody I could respect, okay? And that's...
Patrick Nelson.
The leader of the movement for working families that I want to be a part of, if it's not the Democratic Party, is Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont.
Emily Martz.
I neither see a clear leader. So I would say that's what we're here to figure out, and I'd put it into the hands of the people.
Tedra Cobb.
Okay, this is the moment of truth. It's Joe Biden. I have a crush on Joe Biden.
Ronald Kim.
It's you guys. It's you guys. And that's what's happening around the country, and that's what the Republicans fear. It's you guys.
Katie Wilson.
Ron, you stole my answer. But you know what? I'll take it a step further. I think it's the women of America right now. I mean, we've seen what has happened. So let's own that and let's be proud.
Russ Finley.
Honestly, I think the future leaders of both parties are sitting on this dais right here tonight because we're the people that have stood up, we're standing up to our parties, and we're speaking truth to power, and you people are helping us.
Okay, our third speed round question. Somehow you can't get through a debate without this coming up, so I'll go ahead and ask it. Don Bayajian, President Donald Trump, impeach or not?
Impeach.
As soon as
Steve?
Possible.
Patrick?
That makes three.
Emily?
Let's go through the process so that we can get to that point.
Tedra?
Yes.
I don't think we should impeach at this point. I think we should go through the process because if we impeach without that, I think that things will fall apart. I think it's absolutely irresponsible.
Ronald?
I'm more fearful of Vice President Pence becoming President Pence.
Katie?
Ron, I mean, yeah, that's what's up next. I say we elect another president in a few years and we avoid the Mike Pence of the world leading us.
Russ?
I'm disgusted that this question was even asked. That is horrendous. We're talking about the President of the United States here. The Constitution talks about high crimes and misdemeanors. There's been nothing done, and this was an absolutely disgusting question to be asked. And no, absolutely not.
Tanya?
So, there are a lot of Republicans in our district, and I do think that a lot of them get upset about this. They feel like he's the president, and we need to abide by the process and make sure that he's held accountable if he has committed crimes that would subject him to impeachment.
The fourth speed round, Steve Krieg, you will be the leader on this. Even though some people are upset at the idea of bringing up impeachment, it is something that several Democrats have brought up in Congress. If impeachment is considered in Congress for President Trump, should Vice President Trump also be impeached?
Vice President Pence?
Vice President Pence.
Well, I honestly think there are some grounds to impeach President Trump. I don't see grounds for impeaching Vice President Pence at this point.
So the president is in violation of the Emoluments Clause of the United States Constitution by not divesting himself from his businesses and continuing to take payments from foreign governments. It's the role of a member of Congress to determine the probable cause, and he will be tried in the Senate. So impeachment is beginning the process, not ending it. In regards to Vice President Pence, that should be determined by the results of Robert Mueller's investigation as to whether or not what was there or anything. But in regards to this president currently sitting, it's due to his taking payments from foreign governments.
Emily Martz.
We do need to move this through the process, just like we're moving the president through the process. And I hope to be a part of that if it hasn't happened before I get there.
Kedra Cobb.
Yeah, I think the emoluments clause is important, and I think we need to hold the president accountable. I caution us to communicate with each other and to be respectful. I think that this process tonight, and Russ, I respect you. We've known each other for a long time, and I think that this is where we are as a country. We're very divided, and I think that this discussion needs to go forward. I think that we need to investigate thoroughly, and I think that the Congress and the Senate needs to let all of the investigations that are going forward happen without any pressure, and the president needs to stay out of all of the investigations that are happening as well. I'm not saying that super well, but I really think we need neutrality.
Ronald Kim.
I'm old enough to remember the Watergate hearings and the deliberations that went through and also how that tore our country apart. If I'm elected to Congress, I will certainly support charges against the president or vice president if it's merited, and would also be a vote to impeach if that came to it. But this is new. There are a lot of issues relating to this. There's a lot of evidence that still hasn't been proved. I just think that we're getting a little ahead of ourselves.
Katie Wilson.
In terms of whether Pence should be impeached as well, I believe that we won't know whether that would be a valid move until after the investigation is complete.
Russ Finley.
Again, this was a horrible question. The emoluments clause, where are you getting that? 200 years, nobody's been charged with that, and the guy owns a few hotels, and he rents rooms to everybody. Go ahead and laugh. How about Hillary Clinton selling uranium? How about Maxine Waters getting how many billion-dollar bailout for her husband's bank? How about Nancy Pelosi getting her husband being made a billionaire off of high-speed rail projects? Joe Biden.
This is a bullet round.
I'm firing a lot of bullets. And the hero of the Democrat Party, Bernie Sanders, how many million did he get his wife for the failed college? So you want to talk about, hey, you want to attack my president, ladies and gentlemen? I'm here to tell you, I'm not going to tolerate it.
Okay. We can discuss that in the hall afterwards, okay? Tanya Boone.
I do think we need to let the investigation continue and follow the process.
Don Boyajian.
Articles of impeachment don't necessarily mean removal. What I want to see is a government that's working properly with checks and balances. That's why we need a Congress that can hold the administration accountable. We need to bring checks and balances back.
Okay, we go on now to the fifth speed round question. And Patrick Nelson, you will begin it. Should there be term limits on congressional representatives, and if you agree with that idea, how long?
So I would support an amendment to the United States Constitution that said the following things. No person shall serve in any office of the United States, any state or subdivision thereof, for more than 3 consecutive terms, and no person shall hold any elected office for more than 35 years of their lives.
Emily Martz.
I would support considering it. But given the value that institutional knowledge brings to the table, I don't think we should be considering term limits unless we're also considering finance or campaign finance reform, since indeed that is where a lot of the power lies, is within the money.
Tedra Cobb.
Yeah, I actually do believe in term limits. I think that All elected officials should be have term limits, and in fact, I term limited myself when I was a legislator. And when I went door to door to the 2,800 households, I told people I would run for 2 terms, max 3, and I ran for 2.
Ronald Kim.
Yes, 6 to 8 years.
Katie Wilson.
I believe that the issue, we have term limits, they're called elections. The problem is that an incumbent is so powerful because of the financial backing, and it's really campaign finance reform that we must address. So if we make, if we level the playing field so that anyone is capable and can afford to represent themselves at this level, then we don't have to worry about the limit because the people will determine that each election cycle.
Russ Finley.
I'm a farmer, and the more I'm around politicians, the more I love my cows. So, yes, I want to be here. I want to do a good job. I want to represent the people, and I hope and I pray that I can mentor somebody better, younger, smarter, faster, stronger to come in and take over and take me out, because that's what elections are for.
Tanya Boone.
So I think this is a potential solution to the problem of 85% of incumbents are reelected, and people think Congress is doing a bad job 85% of the time. So it doesn't make sense. Term limits might make sense, but I think campaign finance reform is going to solve that, as well as getting rid of gerrymandering and having fair redistricting.
Don Boyajian.
We forget that this is all about public service. It's not politics, and the best public servants go to different, yes, the answer is yes. And I want to see people, if you're really so committed to serving the public, you'll go find something else to do in public service. That's what I plan to do, and I would support term limits, yes.
Steve Krieg.
Yes, I mean, I came out supporting term limits, and I do, and I would say 10, 12 years, depending on whether you're in the House or the Senate. I think there are other ways to fix this, but that's one of them, and a good one, I think.
Well, that's our first round of speed round questions. I thank you for being patient with the questions and answering them. Now we'll go on to the regular format questions, where they will have 90 seconds to respond to the questions. And this round will begin with Emily Martz. Not that long ago, the region was very concerned about the transport of Bakken oil through the region via rail. Now, demand in transport has diminished, but there's now a new concern. Iowa Pacific, which owns the Saratoga North Creek Railway, is parking out-of-service rail cars, both boxcars and tanker cars, on tracks in the Adirondacks, particularly near Minerva and Newcomb. The company says it could temporarily store up to 2,000 cars legally on those sidings. There's limited action that the state can take because most regulatory oversight is federal. What action do you want from the Surface Transportation Board, and what federal legislative action, if any, would you push for as a House member?
I spoke publicly about this already, and I'm taking my cue from the local organizations and the local governments, and that is that they're not wanted there, and just because the company can do it doesn't mean that they should. And so in Congress, I would take action in order to prevent them from leaving the cars there. The bigger issue surrounding this is that we still have an overabundance of the use of the fossil fuels in our region. And I see this as an opportunity to refocus the attention one more time on clean energy and the clean energy infrastructure. Our region already distributes over half of the clean energy in this state. The jobs that are being created in this region, in this state, in this country are clean energy jobs. So we need to be focusing our attention, as I did in economic development, on how to create more solar installation jobs, biomass jobs, how to get funding for that and prioritize the clean energy sector. So that would be my priority, because it makes sense for generations to come, and it also makes sense for our economy.
Ted Rakob.
I think that this is a good example of a situation where New York State local government and our congressional leaders need to work together to solve the problem. Unfortunately, Elise Stefanik seems to be missing in action, but I think that here we've got on many levels, we've got the DEC, we've got New York State, we've got the Adirondack Park Association, we've got local government, and all of those, this is one example. I think in many of our communities, we have examples where all of us should be working together with our federal representatives to solve problems such as these and to hold companies such as these accountable. In St. Lawrence County, we have GE is still not completely cleaned up. These are, examples of dumping. We've got, situations where we are paying the price for national organizations who have seen us as passive and able to, because we're rural, I think, not able to stand up for ourselves. And so this is an example of how we need to stand together at the state, local and federal level to fight these organizations, these companies, and hold them accountable.
My understanding is that under current law, there's not too much that can be done for this. If I was congressperson, the first thing I would do is I would propose a tax. You see, because even though it's legal for them to do what they're doing, apparently, you can tax them. The House of Representatives is the source of all taxing authority. And so we need to address this through essentially saying, you're going to stay there, we're going to tax you to the hilt. Because ultimately corporations don't like to pay taxes. That's the big debate right now in the Hill, correct? So we need to do that. Because right now it's my understanding that a lot of hands are tied in terms of what – in terms of their ability to store on there. So fine, you're going to pay a tax. Eventually, they'll go away because it's also my understanding that the owners of Iowa Pacific essentially are profiting from this, and they're basically holding Minerva and the local communities hostage for this. So what needs to be done is they need to be taxed. Confiscatory taxing of them will get rid of this problem. And as congressperson, that's what I'll be doing. Now, if I can persuade them to leave, I'll do it. But ultimately, that's what Congress needs to do on this.
I was the one to call attention to this issue and really make it part of this race. And Iowa Pacific has a clear history of extortion across the country, and not just in our country, in fact. They have been in decline as a business for years, and they have been holding areas hostage in order to make money. And now the Adirondack Park has become one of their next victims. So what we must do here, there are things we can do. The Surface Transportation Board showed its authority to deal with the situation when it granted common carrier status to Iowa Pacific under the guise of them enriching our economy through their Polar Express train and a number of other things. And they have not added to the economy. Right now, what needs to happen, and I've called specifically on Elise Stefanik, she has actually, for the first time, responded to a candidate in this race to call on the Surface Transportation Board to declare local jurisdiction, because it's the DEC and the APA, it's our local leaders who know what should and shouldn't be going on in the Adirondack Park, who understand what's going on here. The Adirondack Park is not a junkyard.
I don't believe in tax and sue. I don't believe in all this strong arm tactics, but Ron, I'll give you that. Some of these corporations, they do need to be spanked. But this is also where a representative and a negotiator comes in. If you look at this district, we've got the abandoned GM site sitting up there in Messina. It's already contaminated. Yeah, it's been cleaned up a little bit, but it's sitting there. It's doing nothing, and there's rail access to it. Why aren't we negotiating with the rail companies and saying, you know what, why don't you bring those cars up to Messina? There's a railroad spur right there. We can put in a gantry crane, and we can put the cars there. And the cars that need to be taken out of service, they can be dismantled. Maybe we can set up a vertically integrated scrap operation where we can fire up the old Alcoa East smelter, and we can actually turn this into a business opportunity. But suing and screaming and hollering and doing all this stuff, it's forward thinking and a business plan, and you got to deal with a business like a business. And that's what I say. Let's take those cars out of the Adirondack Park, move them up to Messina, figure out which are going to be used, which aren't going to be used, and we can work on it from there. It's an economic development opportunity for the North Country.
So one of our most important resources is the Adirondack Park in this district, and we need to protect it. So we have to figure out, having 2,000 cars there that could be dangerous and just really junking up the place, is we have to figure out how to prevent that. And I think we have to be clear on what a business wants to do, which is to maximize profit. And I actually like Ron's idea. We need to make it more expensive for them to have the cars there than to remove the cars. So we've got to be creative on how we do that.
I mean, this is right how I started out. This is just a classic example of upstate New York getting a raw deal. And these big corporations think they can do whatever they want whenever it's convenient. Downstate interests think they can do whatever they want whenever it's convenient. And this is just another example of that. And I've dedicated my career to fighting against these types of corporate interests. You know, I represented communities, townships affected by PCBs in the Hudson River. And we had to get a water supply built to somewhere else because we were getting our drinking water out of the Hudson. I represented the Mohawks up at Akwesasne against General Motors. They were eating fish out of the river that were contaminated with PCBs. This is another example just like that. That's why a strong civil justice system is so important, and holding those types of corporate wrongdoers accountable. But a good representative, also know, especially at the federal level, will know how to bring together all the different stakeholders. And Elise is not doing it. I haven't seen it yet, and that's what I would do. That's what this book is about. This is my to-do book. All right. I see a lot of things that Elise is not doing. And if you have an issue in a community, give it to me. I'm going to start working on it right now because we got to hit the ground rolling when we get elected. That's what a good member does. You do a lot more than what just goes on in D.C. So give me your issues and we'll get to work now. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I find this ridiculous that we have a park, Adirondack Park, that it's a place I love, and to see these cars being parked here just angers me. And I thank Katie for working on this. I think I've seen her talk about it, and I thank her for that. You know, as to what I would do about it as a congressperson, one thing I'll say, just sitting here, that I'm thinking of is, as a school board member, what I've learned over time is you have to listen to everybody else on the school board. And when you do, you find out that they have ideas that are almost always better than mine, or at least as good as mine, that I can combine with my ideas to. So I was glad to hear Ron's idea because I thought that was a good one. Also on the school board, I learned in some of the things I've done, one of them I can talk about is we changed Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. The kids asked us to do it, and I worked on it, and one of the things I did was I traded votes with people. I was not really in favor of accepting tuition-paying students in the district. Others were. I didn't feel as strongly about it as I felt about the Indigenous Peoples Day, so I traded. And I would do that with people in Congress to find people that have interests that they want. And work together with them, and even if it comes down to trading votes, that's how I would get things done. Thank you.
So to put the situation in a broader context, the Keystone XL pipeline recently leaked 210,000 gallons of oil in, I believe it's South Dakota. There's no safe way to transport fossil fuels. Pipelines leak, oil cars leak, otherwise they explode. That's why they're called bomb trains. This is why we need to transition from fossil fuel infrastructure to renewable energy as quickly as possible. Thankfully, the market is leading the way. Fossil fuels are a dying industry thanks to market forces. But in order to preserve and protect the legacy of our country and our way of life, we have to get off fossil fuels. That's why, as a member of Congress, I will co-sponsor H.R. 3671. That is the Off Fossil Fuels for a Better Future Act, which was introduced by Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii. This says that by 2035, we will transition the United States to a 100% renewable economy. And one of the key ways we pay for that is by taking away the billions and billions of dollars of subsidies that we're currently giving to fossil fuel companies. They don't need it, and we as a country don't need it. And maybe as an amendment to that act, we can add Ron's suggestion or something similar that says there shall be no transportation through or storage of fossil fuel infrastructure within a 25-mile radius of any legally protected land. And we can enforce that with heavy fines and eventually, if necessary, come in and remove the offending infrastructure.
So we've cycled through the candidates. And Ted Rakab, you get to answer the next question first. There is a project that's been thought of for decades across the North Country and has never been completed. As a member of the House, would you help accelerate and support the rooftop highway, or are you opposed? And if you are opposed, why?
That's a great question. Actually, it's a great question for me in that this project started when I was a legislator. So there are two, I don't know how much people from here know about it, but there are really two plans. There's taking Route 11 and expanding Route 11, but there's also what started out as the rooftop highway, which has now actually kind of, it's changed. It has really metamorphosized into more spurs and not exactly a highway, which was what it was originally proposed. And I will tell you, in the original form, I was against it. The first thing I did when I considered running for Congress was to meet with the proponents of the rooftop highway because it's so crucial to people in our community, and I wanted to understand where it was today. So it has changed. It's not just a four-lane highway going across northern New York. There are actually bike paths and other kinds of things that have been added to this. There are upgrades to Route 11 and some spurs around bypasses that are added. So at this point, in the current form, I would support it. And I thank all those people who've been working on it for so many years to make the changes that have come from the community and the communities that have been concerned about kind of what it was in the original form.
Ronald Kim?
I would support it on a couple conditions. When I was on the city council in Saratoga Springs, we had a proposal for a complete streets. The idea was to revamp our streets, minimize the kinds of signaling, and this was because I was Commissioner of Public Safety. This was directly part of my purview to minimize the traffic signals, et cetera, and also put in bike paths, et cetera. The community was in an uproar about this. If we have a proposal that not only addresses cars, we're stuck with cars for a while, but also bike paths, trails, etc., that actually address more comprehensively the transportation needs of the North Country, and it's consistent with the environmental regulations and gets a neg deck on seeker, that I support it, as long as, again, it's not just favoring cars and transportation, but also looking at the other modes of transportation that are really the ones that are for the future. So as long as it's going in that direction, I'd support it, and I'd be an ally in Congress to help to get federal funds. If it looks like it's simply just going to look at car transportation, I'm a little bit more leery about it. I'm a little less enthusiastic about it. So it really depends on what the direction is of the proposal.
Katie Wilson?
I would absolutely support this project. I was just in Messina this past week, and I was talking to some farmers and producers, and their businesses cannot thrive if they cannot move their goods. You know, we were talking about how Plattsburgh is so lucky. You know, Gary and so many other people have done such a great job of marketing Plattsburgh as a suburb of Montreal. And that's because the border is there. There's access. There's transportation. That isn't available in Messina. You think about, I mean, the space between here and, say, Potsdam and then Potsdam and, you know, Watertown is like the forgotten frontier of the North Country. There's nothing there to They face more challenges than even some of these other towns and small cities in the area. We must, if we're serious about investing in the local economy, create access and transportation availability in these areas. And, you know, the bike paths and everything that comes with it, this is how we grow communities. This is part of community infrastructure. We need that in the North Country as well. It helps families come. It makes towns more desirable to move to. It creates a sense of community in a town like Messina that desperately needs it.
Russ Finley.
First of all, I want to do a clarification. There's this word investment being constantly used. Government does not invest, it spends, and it spends your money. So every time they say invest, they're talking about spending your money. Now, as far as roads go, Tedra will concur that when she was a legislator, I was kind of a thorn in their side. I used to follow the legislature around and see what they were doing. And I'm just going to give you a couple examples. St. Lawrence County decided to take over this road from the town of Canton, the Pike Road. And they said, oh, we can build a new bridge, we can widen the road, we can do everything. It will only cost $135,000. The last FOIL request that I got cost me about $200 at 25 cents a page. It was that thick. And the Pike Road, a stretch of, what is it, Tedra, a mile and a half? About a mile and a half, 2 miles, $990,000. And if you want to look at, if you want to talk about what this is going to cost, go down to Fort Drum and look at what they call the 781 extension. It's about a 4 mile stretch from Fort Drum over to Route 81. And it was sold as a $4 million project that became a $40 million project that became almost a $200 million project for 4 miles. Now, what do you think that highway is going to cost us if they try and do it?
Tanya Boone.
So Russ is right. Investment does mean spending. And to be clear, whenever we spend $1 billion in infrastructure, that equates to about 18,000 good jobs. So it can be a very good thing. And I think this is one project that can be very good. It's when I first started talking to folks throughout the district, this is one that came up. And I know it's been under consideration, it sounds like, for about 60 years, and it's evolved. The way that I view things, because I haven't ever held public office before, but I have been a union organizer and I have been a small business owner, is to make sure to talk to folks and make sure it makes sense and make sure that any investment that we do provides good jobs. It sounds like this is one that would, but I know that there are concerns about Route 11, too, and businesses being lost there. So I'd want to just investigate it more and make sure that it makes sense overall, but it sounds like it does.
Don Boyajian.
You know, Russ, I think you're totally wrong on that point, because there was a time when our country and our Congress invested in America. Investing does require spending some money, but there was a time. Think about the New Deal. Think about the building, the creation of the highway system. That was the democracy that I liked. That was investing in America, and that's what we need up here. And, you know, I've studied several iterations, like everybody else has, of the rooftop highway. In its current form, it's pretty darn good. I mean, what's it about? It's all about job creation in that region, because they're hurting. I mean, you look at Messina, 30 years ago, its population was 60-some-odd thousand. It's down to like 18,000 or something like that. That is a bad trajectory. And that's why I'm such a big proponent on infrastructure investment. It's a great thing a freshman member of Congress can do. And like I said earlier, you sit on that committee as a freshman, you can make sure those grant programs, like community development block grants, get boosted in ways that go right to your district. And that's, you know, the counties and the municipalities, they know where the need is. And that ultimately will save the local taxpayer money. That's investing in America.
Steve Creek?
Yeah, I think we need to invest in infrastructure, but I'm not so sure about these big new infrastructure projects. I grew up in western New York, Chautauqua County, Jamestown area. We had a road when I was a kid. Route 17 went across the southern tier of the state. At the time I was growing up, they wanted to build an interstate highway essentially through there, and they did. It was expensive at that time. I'm sure it would cost much, much more today. It did not do that much for economic development in the southern tier, at least in that part of the state, it did not. you know, it's not necessarily if you build it, they will come. I think if you have to, if you look at these big new projects, you have to carefully study them and see if the demand is there. And if you're thinking it's going to create demand, you have to come up with some really good plans of what demand it's going to create, because these things are expensive, and I personally would rather spend the money upgrading the infrastructure we already have, working in places that we can, we know will help, let's look a little bit more carefully at these big projects before we invest a lot of money in them or spend a lot of money in them, as Russ says.
Patrick Nelson.
You know, the words we speak into these microphones are going to be available for anyone to hear around the world. Show of hands, how many people here heard about this event through some form of social media, Facebook, Twitter? All of that is made possible because the government made the decision to invest in something called the internet. Government indeed can invest. Now, when it comes to the rooftop highway, let me tell you what's going on in the back of everybody's mind as we're driving around this 15,000 square mile district every day. Boy, we wish it was already built. So I would support the rooftop highway. I said it earlier. It needs to be done in an environmentally conscious fashion. I know people have some concerns. We need to be able to manage that so that the communities support it. That's why we need congressional representatives that do town halls and hear back from constituents so that when we do these projects, we do them in the least intrusive way possible. But it's necessary, as I said, for our farmers to make it easier for them to get their goods to market and feed the broader Northeast, which they're going to be doing with climate change. It's also really important for our veterans. We have the largest concentration of veterans in the 21st Congressional District than any other district, and yet we don't have a full-service VA hospital. So for our veterans that are living in Malone, Messina, Ogdensburg, having this highway available to them makes it easier for them to get to either Syracuse or Albany to get the care they deserve.
Emily Martz.
We know that prosperity exists where the flow of goods and services exists, and that includes the flow of people. It includes the flow of food from farms, products to and from businesses, and so I support the idea for that reason. It attracts visitors, new residents when they're looking for a place to live. We know want to make sure that they have easy access to other areas. It will allow the businesses to expand access to new markets, and that's what economic development is all about, expanding markets for our businesses. So as long as this is comprehensive, as long as it does indeed include multiple modes of transportation, as I've been learning that it does, I absolutely support this. And I'd also like to make sure that in the plans and in the contracts are the use of union workers and the use of local materials and workers to the extent possible. I think that's essential if we're talking about this in terms of local economic development. That needs to be a priority. And then finally, I'd start the next phase right away, which is how do we make the most of this? Talking with the local businesses, the organizations, the elected officials, what are the plans for this and how can I help take that next step right now?
Well, thank you, candidates. We will now move to our next speed round section. And I kind of hope the answers are a little bit shorter than some of the ones we had in the first section of speed rounds. The first answer in this speed round will come from Ronald Kim. Mr. Kim, who is your favorite U.S. president, living or dead?
Abraham Lincoln.
Katie?
I'm going to say that, you know, I like Jimmy Carter.
Russ Finley?
Jefferson.
Tanya Boone?
Teddy Roosevelt.
Don Boyash.
She beat me to it. That's not fair. You know, Bull Moose Party, big outdoorsman, you got to go Teddy Roosevelt.
I got to go Abraham Lincoln.
I'm going to take a two-for-one and just say Roosevelt.
I'll take Jimmy Carter, especially for the class with which he's performed after he's been president.
That isn't fair.
Tedra?
Yeah. Well, you got a two-for-one, so I think Abraham Lincoln and Jimmy Carter.
Okay, our next speed round question, Katie Wilson, you get to answer first. How many Adirondack High Peaks have you climbed?
I don't know. I've lived here my whole life. I have no idea, but I can tell you that the ones I love, I climb over and over again. I don't keep track. I just love them all.
Russ Finley?
Can't say I'm a 46er, but I've got over 100 climbs in my belt.
Tanya Boone?
I hike around, but I can't say I go up a lot.
I was talking with some folks earlier. I'm a big backcountry skier, and I'm actually working on my winter 46, actually skiing all 46. Ron Conowitz, I don't know if anybody knows who that is, childhood hero of mine. I skied about 10 of the high peaks. I do a lot of slide skiing. So I did about 10 last winter. Long
short,
way to go.
Short,
some of those are
short.
Tough. Okay, I get excited about skiing. Sorry.
I've done a lot of them. I don't know how many, but I never had that as my goal to get all 46. I agree with Tanya. Now I'm an older guy, and I like the hikes that don't go up so high. And there are some beautiful ones in the Adirondacks, including OK Slip Falls and this new place I haven't been to yet, the ponds. I can't think of the name of the ponds. But anyway, I'm going there next year sometime.
Patrick?
The last time I went hiking, it was Sleeping Beauty Peak, which is not a 46er, and was on a date with a young woman who did that regularly, and she ran circles around me. So I haven't made it to any of the 46, but I would like to at some point.
Emily Martz?
I love hiking. I'm not sure how many I've hiked, probably as many in the winter as in the summer. Unfortunately, not too many lately. Not any lately.
Tedra?
None. I'm not a hiker, but I've done a lot of Zumba.
Mr.
I don't know exactly how many, but I did get lost on East Dix. I think it was East or it was South Dix because we were bushwhacking. So totally lost, but I don't know how many exactly.
Our next speed round question, Russ Finley, you get to answer first. What philosopher would you most like to have a conversation with?
I don't know. I don't speak Latin, so
Tanya?
You know, philosophy comes from a lot of people, a lot of various forms. So any one philosopher, no. Listening to everybody and their philosophies, yes.
I don't think I've taken up my whole time with answers, so I'm more succinct. So philosophy is not really my thing.
I gotta say, you know, my grandfather, he passed away a year ago, next month, and he had the greatest mind of anybody I ever know, and my grandfather.
Steve Craig?
I'm gonna say Socrates. I enjoy that method that he came up with, and I would like to talk to him more about it.
Patrick Nelson?
I'm gonna go in another twofer and say John Rawls and Immanuel Kant.
Emily Martz?
I was going to say, it would be a one-sided conversation, but I would like to talk with Socrates so that I could learn more about his communication style.
Tedra Cobb?
I'm not sure people would consider him a philosopher, but rather a religious leader, and it would be Ernesto Cardenal.
Ronald Kim?
Machiavelli.
Katie Wilson?
I was engaged to a philosopher, actually not too long ago. And I can say that I'm kind of done with those conversations for a little while.
I think Russ Finley was probably at the disadvantage throwing that question at him first. Everybody else had a chance to think. The next question in the speed round, Tanya Boone, you will get to answer it first. With this district bordering Canada, parlez-vous français?
I can't even think of a French word to say. No.
No.
No, I was in France recently, and I was glad my daughter was there because she spoke it a little bit. So.
Nada.
Bonjour, Alice. Bonjour, Philippe. Ça va? Oui, ça va. Et tu? Pas mal.
Show off.
That's from 7th grade French. That's all I've got.
Okay. Tedra?
Je parle un petit peu. I just speak a little bit, but I am fluent in Spanish.
I don't speak English that well. So.
Katie?
I don't, but I remember one time in a bar in college, someone taught me a phrase in Spanish or in French, and I actually can't remember why, but it was "tu as mal poisson," you are a bad fish.
Yeah.
And Ross.
The Little Mermaid.
Mais oui, je m'appelle Ross. Et vous? Other than that, I can order a beer and pick a fight with you and probably swear and offend your family.
Okay, our next speed round question, Don Boyajian, you get to answer first. This is a holiday week. How do you spend the majority of your time during Thanksgiving?
With my family. And fishing.
Yeah, with my family.
Eating, watching football.
This year I'm doing the turkey trot for Bitters and Bones in Saranac Lake in the morning, and then I am going to go to Malone to help with the community meal that the church is having.
Tedra?
I'm an amazing sous chef, so I like to sit and cut vegetables and drink wine and talk with my family.
I can't cook. My wife is a wonderful cook, and we're two Thanksgivings, one in the Adirondacks, and then we're going to Boston to see her mother.
Katie?
This is my favorite holiday, and I spend the entire time cooking and eating and just hanging with loved ones. There's no pressure. That's why Thanksgiving is the best. It's gratitude that we all need more of.
I'm a farmer, so like every day since August 13th, 1998, I'm going to be working. I'm going to be taking care of my cows to make sure that my cows are well cared for so that you people can have three meals a day. That's what farmers do. We work every day for you.
I spend time in very comfy clothes, and my mom is one of those that skips right over Thanksgiving, so we do a lot with Christmas decorating on Thanksgiving. But we do give lots of thanks for having the family around in the moment, putting Christmas decorations up.
So that's the end of our speed round, and we've now come to the final question of the night, which is another 90-second response question. The first answer is from Steve Krieg. Why do you believe you are the best candidate to defeat the incumbent in 2018?
I think that I have experience in this district. I'm a veteran, which I think gives me a few votes that I might not get if I wasn't a veteran. I think I have good ideas. I think I care about people, which I would put down as one of the top values that I have. I care about the people of this district. I take care of people every day in my work, and they're important to me. And I always look at them as my job, not making money. It's taking care of those people. And I would look at the people of this district and the people of this country as my job. I'm on the school board, and my main concern is always for kids. I like kids a lot. I want to see them grow up and do well, and I want to see them be able to have decent lives. And at least I think will make a good case that she's bipartisan. And I've never known her, when push comes to shove, she's going to side with a big business, and I will push her on that as hard as I can.
Patrick Nelson.
So my work throughout this district over the last several years has given me a unique opportunity to do something. And that's, I've knocked on thousands of doors in this district. I've made thousands of phone calls. I've been to tons of events. I have had probably more one-on-one conversations with the people that live in this district than anybody else living. And from that experience, you'll learn a lot. First, you mess up a few times and you realize what doesn't go over very well, and you learn not to do that again. But you also learn that there's two people you're never going to meet in life. And number one is someone who agrees with everything that you believe in. Doesn't exist. But number two is someone who disagrees with everything you believe in. With every person you meet, there is some commonality. And the skill we need to learn is how do we maximize our agreements instead of focusing always on our disagreements and the things that divide us. I've had conversations with self-described conservatives that hate handouts from the government but are still in favor of Medicare for All because they understand the value. So we have a common set of values in this district that I have learned from talking with folks like yourselves and folks throughout the broader district, learning the distinctions of each and every one of our communities and the special issues that are in each community. But we have a common set of values of taking care of our environment, of taking care of each and every one of us in having a strong community, and in building a country that works for all of us.
Emily Martz.
The new leadership that we need in this district is someone who can demonstrate and connect with the people of our rural district, someone who understands the challenges that most of us face. And again, I grew up in a one-income household in a 2,000-person town. And for us, vegetables came out of a can, and milk came out of powder in a box, and the clothes were hand-me-downs. But I was taught to work hard. Thanks to a public education and neighbors helping me along the way, I was able to have success, and I feel that commitment to giving back at this point in time. And we also need someone who knows how to help create the opportunities that we need, and that's my background. My career has been in economic development for 20 years, and I understand what it takes to create small businesses, to help expand markets, whether it's in the clean energy sector, the artisans, or the farmers. And I love people, and I love connecting with people, and that's what we need most from our leader, and that's what is so sorely missing. And we have seen a wave of new leadership in this district since the fall elections, and it's a wave of people made up mostly of women who said after the 2016 elections, I want to do something, I can do something, and if you tell me that the chances are too low and that the hurdles are too high, I'm going to do it anyway because I know together we can win. And that is the commitment and that is the conviction that I have and that we need to bring to the table. Thank you.
Ted Rakoff.
I've been a public servant. I chose to be a public servant, and I'm choosing to be a public servant again. And I'm running this campaign, by networking and reaching out. That's my style. That's who I am. I will remain true to who I am running for office. I will remain true to who I am if I'm elected. That's what I'm asking you, to support me in this very long race and to join with me and unify the district. That is why I think that I'm a great candidate, because my style is to unify. My style is to collaborate. My style is to solve problems. I'd like to circle back to the beginning and talk about compassionate and competent government. That's what I bring. That's what I wake up in the morning when I put on either my suit or whatever it is when I get out here and I talk with all of you and people around the district. It's about public servant, being a public servant. It's about the principles of compassionate and competent government, and I hope to bring those, and I hope to network and work with all of you as your representative, and I want to thank you for your time tonight.
Ronald Kim.
I think I'm the best qualified because I'm a good listener, but I'm a better fighter. I'll give you a concrete example of that. When I took office as the Commissioner of Public Safety in Saratoga Springs, it was in the middle of a scandal. The Republican commissioner who I had succeeded was essentially, there was a variety of charges. There was questions of misappropriation of money, et cetera. His deputy commissioner was actually suing the city, and the chief of police was suing the city. So I walked into this department with this kind of situation. The first thing I did, I sat down with all the important people and I listened to them. I wanted to hear what was really going on in the department. I realized that if we didn't get this department together and mission focused, largely we're going to fail. And there's a consequence to fail in the public safety department. You got police, fire, EMS. These are people that are the first responders. They need to focus on mission, not politics. So I got them all together. We listened. And then there were some clear things that they needed out of their city that they felt neglected, that had nothing to do with the previous administration, except they had been ignored, and I started fighting for them. Those are the qualities that I'll bring to this job. Those are the qualities that are needed in the Congress, in this congressional district, and that's what you'll have if you elect me.
Katie Wilson.
The biggest challenge we face in 2018 is turning people out to vote, and it's going to take something exciting and something unique. We must work together. Right now, we have a representative who's the youngest female ever elected to Congress. Well, I am a millennial, too. I'm actually just a few months older than Elise. I could be the youngest female Democrat ever elected to Congress. This is a story. It's something that's been getting national visibility, and that's what it's going to take in order for us to bring this race up into the public eye so that the DCCC comes in and invests the kind of money we need to win this. I'm also a member of the working class. When was the last time we had a true working class representative? Could you imagine what that would be like? This is an opportunity to unify the district. There are so many moderate Republicans and independents all across this district. Most of them are working class, just like myself. This is our time. This could be our time. But we have to do it together. I'm here to ask for your support. We can take this seat back in 2018 if we work together.
Russ Finley.
Well, I find myself once again saying, thank God most of you aren't Republican primary voters. The biggest thing tonight is I've been told all my life, you're not good enough. When I walked onto the bobsled track, you're too short, you're too small, you're too this, you're too that. I made the U.S. bobsled team 7 times, was a USA 1-4, set 2 world records, held 2 national titles. I wanted to become a farmer, so I bought a farm. Everybody told me, you've got no chance of making it. So I named my farm No Chance Farms, and here I am 20 years later, still farming. I was told I got into real estate. Oh, you're never going to go anywhere unless you work for a big company. I worked for a small broker for 2 years, went on my own, and I've been that way ever since. I've been told I'm not good enough my entire life, and I've always fought to prove that I was better than that. And the one thing that I want everybody here to remember, before any of you get to Elise, she's got to go through me. And the big difference is, ladies and gentlemen, I'm here for the 4th time. I'm here. I'm here with you all. I'm here talking to you and listening to you. And she's in Montreal. And that's the big difference. I'm here. She's got to get through me.
Tanya Boone.
So I think that Elise Stefanik is really a follower, not a leader. And I think that her experience as a Washington insider, where she went from working for George W. Bush to Paul Ryan to running for office, doesn't serve us well. My experience is unique, and I think that you do have to bring to office some real-world experience that you can draw from. So I was a union organizer for 12 years. That means I got up every morning thinking about how to improve working families' lives in the workforce, in the workplace. I've been a small business owner, a struggling small business. We actually bought our business right at the brink of the Great Recession. So we had a lot of very painful experiences going through that and figuring out how to keep it alive and how to make sure that it still employs 40 families. But I think that real-world experience is really critical. And in terms of winning the race, I think we've also got to reach out to struggling Republicans who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump. When I first launched my campaign, I got a group of friends together, and these are mostly high school friends that are Trump supporters. And when I went through my experience and I said, you know, the way I view this is to view every action through the lens of what makes things better for working people. And they said to me, oh, you're a different kind of Democrat. And I said, no, not really. And they said, you talk about workers. You talk about working people. And that's different. I thought, that's not different for a Democrat.
Don Boyajian.
So the question is how we're going to beat Elise, correct? Basically.
Basically.
You know how? This book is how. Because she's not doing her job. We're working on issues right now. I'm working on zoning issues for different towns. I'm working on issues all around the district. I've worked in every branch of government, in every level of government. I work as a town attorney right now for several towns in upstate New York. I worked in the Attorney General's Office, Environmental Protection Bureau, and I worked in federal government, Congress, and worked at the clerkship at the Securities Exchange Commission. Understanding the interplay between those systems in a government that doesn't get anything done nowadays, that's incredibly powerful. And I'm putting it to use right now. Elise is not doing her job, and I also think she's not accessible. And I'm going everywhere all the time, and I don't, you know, I'm going every hunting and fishing. I'm a big fisherman, and I play in a bluegrass band, and I try to, you know, I go to every hunting and fishing club I can find, and I go to every VFW that's having a bluegrass jam that I can find, and I go play, because those people don't usually get included in these discussions, and they deserve to be. So how are we going to beat her? By doing the work she isn't doing, and that's what I'm doing now, because we deserve somebody that's getting things done. This is public service, and there's a lot more to being a public servant than just taking votes down in D.C. That's what this book is about, and this is how we're going to beat Elise.
So that concludes the North Country Respect 21st District Congressional Forum. Y'all can applaud now if you'd like. Please don't forget to return your response sheets as you leave. And I'd like to thank our candidates for joining us. I'd like to thank you for joining us. I'd like to thank North Country Respect and Buck Bobbin for organizing and sponsoring the forum, and Clinton Community College for hosting us. Thanks to Rick Batchelder and the college's building and grounds crew for setting the stage. I hope we've provided some insight. And don't forget, the primary for the House candidates is June 26, 2018. The general election is November 6, 2018. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.